Ever wondered if all you've read about Marie Antoinette is true? Did she really say, let them eat cake? And was she indeed the fashion-obsessed woman we've been led to believe she was? So much has been written about the last Queen of France, some of it true, some of it not, and many of the facts about Marie Antoinette aren't what you'd expect. But before we dive into this episode, I do want to remind you to go to lifeinruralfrance.com/podcast, where you'll discover everything you ever wanted to know about France. You'll be able to sign up for special offers and hear about deals on hotels, more, and of course, when I release a new episode. Bonjour and welcome to the Life in Rural France podcast. I'm Kylie Lang, a British blogger living in the beautiful Charente region of rural France with my long-suffering hubby Richard and border collie Lottie. Now, unlike most people, moving to France hasn't always been my dream. But that didn't stop me jumping at the chance when hubby, who has never lived anywhere other than Leeds, England, suggested we go live in France. And 6+ years later, we're still here, living in a property we've renovated and a life that if you told me 10 years ago I'd be leading, I would not have believed you. But it's not all about me on this podcast. I'm going to be sharing the hidden gems I've discovered in France, some fascinating stories about French history, and plenty of culture thrown in for good measure. So I invite you to join me on this journey of living in a tiny French commune, getting to grips with learning French, singing to ABBA in the fields, walking my dog, and discovering the joys of the rural life. One thing I can promise you is it won't be boring. And who knows what we might discover together on this roller coaster ride of life in rural France. Oh my goodness, do I have a good episode for you today. Well, as I've told you before, I am an absolute history geek. I spend a lot of my time researching French history and then going to the places where that history took place. And like many of you, I am fascinated by Marie Antoinette. She was only 14 years old when she left her home, her family, and literally everything she knew in order to marry the Dauphin of France. She was really just a pawn in a political game. She had absolutely no say in where she lived or who she married. And when she got to the court in Versailles, all those complexities were really heightened to an overwhelming point. But she's always painted as being immoral, selfish, indulgent. But that's how history has painted her to be. But did she really spend an obscene amount of money on clothes, parties, shoes, whilst the rest of France starved? Or was it a whole PR machine that was going on behind her during those times? Was she just seriously misunderstood? Was she just heavily influenced by her upbringing and the environment of the French court? Well, you know what? She has been depicted as this completely indulgent woman in so many movies, but she actually had a lot of moments of generosity and kindness as well. She was a huge supporter of charitable causes, and she adopted quite a few children, and they were all ones that were seriously in need of her help. But the thing was, in those days, the aristocracy, the royalty, they had this deep-rooted belief in the divine right of monarchy. They held really traditional views about the social hierarchy and their places within it, and Marie Antoinette was no different. You know, this perspective was completely at odds with what was basically a really rapidly changing political landscape in France. And she was just ripe for people writing about her. There was a real rising tide of revolutionary sentiment, and she was at the center of it all. And the latter years of her life, they were marked by personal loss, political upheaval, public vilification, but she showcased her resilience. You know, there was something about her where she really faced her challenges with a certain stoicism. The way she held herself during her trial of execution, she was dignified. So there's this aspect of her personality that really highlights her strengths, and they're just overlooked because everybody focuses on her earlier lives. So let's discover the truths and the untruths about Marie Antoinette. Ready? Number one, did she say let them eat cake? I've written an entire blog post around this one thing. But it's one of those enduring myths about Marie Antoinette supposedly saying, let them eat cake, when she found out that the rest of, you know, the French peasantry had no bread. But there is absolutely no historical evidence to suggest that she ever said it. It's more likely that it came from political propaganda. There was many, many people out there who wanted to paint her as indifferent to the plight of the poor because they wanted to turn people against her. But this phrase was first mentioned by Jean-Jacques Rousseau in his autobiography, Confessions. And that was written when Marie Antoinette was a child. He says a great princess, without naming anyone specifically, said that phrase. Historians, on the other hand, have speculated that he might be referring to Queen Marie Therese, who was the wife of Louis XIV. So, no, there is no evidence to suggest that Marie Antoinette said, let them eat cake. How extravagant was she? Well, number two is all about the extravagance, but she actually wasn't the most extravagant person in Versailles. Or at the Versailles court. Versailles, for all its architectural grandeur and beauty, was actually a place of squalor. It didn't have proper sanitation facilities and it was notoriously dirty. In fact, it stank. Animals used to roam around freely and they'd leave little presents for you everywhere. It's hard to imagine when you go to Versailles now, and I have been, but it was filthy. So, for that reason, it meant that the palace floors were usually filthy as well. So many of the nobles would change their footwear regularly. This practice of having lots of shoes was driven more by necessity than fashion. And it is said that Marie Antoinette, along with other members of the court, used to wear a different pair of shoes every day. They would throw them away. But it was because of this. In fact, Louis XVI's brother outspent the queen in many things, but including his wardrobe. And he is said to have ordered at least 365 pairs of shoes a year. And there was also this rivalry at court, the rivalry of the riches. Everybody wanted to outdo the other. Everybody wanted to display their wealth and luxury. And so whilst Marie Antoinette was definitely not innocent when it came to, you know, extravagant habits, she didn't introduce luxury to Versailles. It was already there. It was well established. And she wasn't the most extravagant figure at court. That reputation, unearned. It was part of this broader culture of lavishness that really defined the French nobility of her era. She didn't create it. She stepped into it. So here's number three, a little unknown fact. Well, unknown if you've never sort of researched it, but she actually brought her own chocolatier to Versailles. So Marie Antoinette loved chocolate. And in France at that time, chocolate was very much only available to the nobility. It hadn't reached the masses. So when she came to Versailles, she brought her own chocolate maker with her. And the title was Chocolate Maker to the Queen. But her love of chocolate also had a bit of a practical aspect as well. There was a royal family chemist, and he came up with the idea of combining medicine with chocolate to help Marie Antoinette because she hated the taste of medicine. Don't blame her. Don't like it particularly myself. So she had these chocolate coins known as pistoles developed, and they were developed specifically for her. And it helped to just take away the bitter taste of the medicine with the chocolate. It just made it more palatable for her. And they are still made today by the same chocolatier company, De Bourvon Gallet. They still exist in Paris. They are the company behind those pastels, still out there today. So number four, did you know that her favorite flowers were cornflowers? She loved the color of the blue corn flower. They used to grow wild in the meadows there. And so much so, she commissioned for them to create a special royal service adorned with motifs of pearls and cornflowers. And it was kind of a common theme for her, this whole love of the natural world. And she used to really like being in nature, being in the countryside, which is, you know, very much reflected in the Petit Trianon, which was her pastoral retreat from court life. Number five, she liked to dress down as much as she liked to dress up. Now that seems so not in keeping with her character, but she had this white dress. It became quite infamous, actually. It was this infamous white dress, which showcased her passion for dressing down. And this dress was known for its simplicity, and it was a real scandalous departure from, you know, all the heavily corseted and ornate fashions of the French court. And it was a muslin gown, and it was really, really plain. And it was referred to as the chemise à la reine, the chemise of the queen. And this dress was really revolutionary for its time because it was worn without any of the corseting that they would have worn at that time. As I said, it was made from muslin, which was very much a fabric associated with the colonies and the burgeoning slave trade. And it really embraced a level of comfort and simplicity that was previously unseen in royal attire. So, interesting little fact there. So, its design, it was a really stark contrast to all those lavishly beaded and embroidered gowns that she normally wore. And it really did make it a subject of scandal and intrigue because it wasn't just a fashion statement, it was a political one. And it really ignited discussions and controversies that went way beyond the confines of courtly fashion. It was really representing Marie Antoinette's desire for personal freedom. It was a break from those rigid formalities of court life. But, like so many things that she did, it drew criticism because of its perceived immodesty. As far as people were concerned, it really symbolized her detachment from the realities of French society at the time. But here's what I love, and you know, so much of this happens with Marie Antoinette. You know, it, despite all these controversies, the chemise à la reine, it influenced fashion trends beyond France. Marie Antoinette was gifting this muslin to friends, and so she was spreading the style across Europe. So she was leaving her mark on the fashion world in a very different way. Number six, I've heard this so many times now that I don't think I can't believe it. I think I have to believe it. But Marie Antoinette's last words were an apology to her executioner, which I just think is actually quite representative of who she was. I said at the beginning, she had dignity. And her final words before her execution on October the 16th, 1793, were apparently an apology for stepping on the foot of her executioner, Henri Sanson. Apparently, what she actually said was, "Pardonnez-moi, monsieur, je ne l'ai pas fait après," which means, "Pardon me, sir, I did not do it on purpose," or words to that effect. Depends on the source. But to me, that just makes her more human, you know, but it does highlight that really stark contrast between her royal upbringing and the brutal reality of her final days. Knowing that, I have a respect for her that I didn't have before. And above and beyond all else, it just makes me feel so sorry for her. Number seven. Now, you may know this, you may not. Poor Marie Antoinette couldn't even give birth in private. Oh, no. As if giving birth isn't hard enough, but imagine doing it in front of the entire French court of Versailles. It was a practice that actually was, it was more practical than anything else. It wasn't about, you know, entertainment because they didn't have TV. It was actually designed to ensure the legitimacy of the heir to the throne. So because you've got witnesses present, it confirms the authenticity of the birth. Because there was always that fear that a child might be smuggled in, lay false claim to the throne. You know, there was so much pressure in those days to produce a son and heir that they would go to literally any lengths to secure the throne. So when Marie Antoinette gave birth to her first child, Marie Therese Charlotte, on December 19th, 1778, the event, it was witnessed by a crowd that literally filled the room to bursting point. And apparently, according to historians, it was so chaotic and suffocating that the Queen fainted due to lack of air. So the King threw the windows open so the fresh air could come in. And that kind of then laid way to a slight relaxation in the strictness of the practice for subsequent births. But the tradition of public royal births didn't go anywhere. It was like that for every single one of them. And it just, I think it, the things like this help you to see that intense scrutiny and pressure that she faced as queen. You know, her personal and her public life, they were just linked inextricably. So although she did lead a very privileged life, that life wasn't her own. There were so many sacrifices, including her ultimate demise. Number eight, this is a horrible one. She was accused of molesting her own son, Louis Charles. It was political manipulation at its absolute best. It was completely unfounded. So the claim emerged during the height of the revolution. And you've got to remember, this was a time of extreme political turmoil. There was widespread paranoia. The monarchy were vilified. Its members were subjected to vicious rumors, accusations. So Louis Charles was the second child, but first son of Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI. He was born in 1785 and he was known as the Dauphin of France. So after the execution of his father in 1793, he was then known as King Louis XVII by the royalists, but he never actually ruled. And during the revolution, as you probably know, the royal family were imprisoned. And in July 1793, Louis Charles was taken from his mum and he was placed in the care of a cobbler called Antoine, and he was appointed as his guardian by the revolutionary government. This accusation of molestation, it was part of a broader campaign to discredit Marie Antoinette and really justify the revolutionary government's actions against her. In 1793, as part of the preparation for her trial, the revolutionary tribunal coerced Louis Charles into claiming that his mother and his aunt had sexually abused him. These claims were baseless. It's probably highly likely that they were extracted through manipulation. And that just shows the extreme lengths that these revolutionaries would go to vilify the Queen. She was tried by that revolutionary tribunal on many different charges, including treason, depletion of the national treasury, conspiracy against the security of the state. The allegations of incestuous abuse were intended to shock and horrify the public, so that if there was any remaining sympathy for the Queen, this was sure to stamp it out. And it worked. Marie Antoinette was convicted, and as we know, executed by guillotine on October the 16th, 1793. Unfortunately, Louis Charles also had a pretty tragic ending as well, and he died in 1795 under really harsh conditions during his imprisonment. And I think his health and spirit were just broken by the ordeal he'd endured. I mean, he was only a child. Number nine, her marriage wasn't consummated for 7 years. Okay, this one is apparently true. But what everyone seems to conveniently forget is that when Marie Antoinette got married, she was only 14. Louis XVI was 15. They were kids. They didn't have a clue what they were doing. That would really probably explain why, for the first couple of years, the marriage wasn't consummated. But, of course, as things did in those days, it became the subject of just a ridiculous amount of speculation and gossip, but not just in the court of Versailles, but across Europe as well. And as we know, Versailles was rife for gossip. There was a lot of, or there has been a lot of speculation over why it took 7 years to consummate the marriage. Well, there's many different theories, but one of them, which could well be the truth, suggests that Louis XVI suffered from a condition known as phimosis, and it's a medical issue that make erections very painful and intercourse, if not difficult, sometimes impossible. And it wasn't an uncommon condition to have, but it could be corrected with surgery, which apparently he did have. So that's where that one comes from. But there was this massive pressure to consummate the marriage and produce an offspring. It was huge. You know, the public nature of those marital difficulties would have certainly added to the stress and embarrassment for both of them. Not to mention, the royal pair were just expected to navigate this intimate relationship with little to no instruction. You know, it was actually a taboo subject at court, which I find very strange, because the Versailles court was a place where mistresses were accepted. Everyone seemed to be jumping into bed with each other. But it wasn't until 1777, after an intervention from Marie Antoinette's brother, Emperor Joseph II of Austria, who visited France and spoke with both of them, that the marriage was finally consummated. And they had their first child, Marie Thérèse Charlotte, and she was born in December in 1778. Number 10. You may or may not know, she was called Madame Defossé, which a derogatory nickname given to her by her critics during the financial crisis that had plagued France in the years leading up to the French Revolution. By the late 1780s, France really was in a severe economic and financial crisis, you know, and this had been made worse by years of war, including its involvement in the American Revolution, poor fiscal management, an outdated tax system, and all that placed the burden on the peasantry, but it didn't really, it exempted the nobility and clergy. So amidst this backdrop of financial turmoil, Marie Antoinette's expenditures, and they were high on things like fashion, entertainment, the construction and maintenance of her private retreat, the Petit Trianon, they became symbols of the monarchy's disconnect from the struggles of the French people. So it's little wonder that she got that nickname. And of course, it always comes down to good marketing, doesn't it? Everything comes down to good marketing. The marketers of that time, they were producing these pamphlets with her image on them using this nickname, which, of course, helped to inflame the situation. And the Queen's lavish spending was not obviously solely responsible for France's financial woes, but it was a really convenient focal point for all that public discontent. Plus, the fact that she was Austrian, it kind of made her a target for anti-monarchists. And that was just another thing that added fuel to the fire. And that nickname, Madame Defossé, encapsulated that frustration. You know, the anger of this population who had been burdened by taxes and poverty. And they just saw the Queen as someone who embodied all of those excesses and inequalities that had been brought on by this ancient regime. Number 11, she nearly escaped imprisonment during her flight to Varennes. So that is actually true. The royal family tried to flee Paris and reached the safety of a royalist stronghold in Montmédy, and that's near the northeastern border of France. The escape was meticulously planned, but it had a spectacular fail, and it's famously known now as the flight to Varennes. A lot of it came down to Louis XVI's hesitation and procrastination. It did play quite a big role in why the escape plan failed. And he was understandably worried about the consequences if the escape attempt did fail. He was concerned over the loyalty of his troops and the people outside Paris. So anyway, they were disguised as servants and they left the Tuileries Palace late at night on June the 20th. But they weren't very good at disguising themselves as servants because they went in an absolutely massive carriage that made them look extremely conspicuous. It made their progress really slow. And that, combined with Louis's insistence on stopping all the time for a variety of reasons, for eating, resting, and God knows what else, just made things worse. But the final nail in that coffin was the king's decision to reveal his identity to the postmaster in one of the towns that they went through. That postmaster recognized him from the currency. He then rode ahead to Varennes, where he and others set up a blockade to intercept the royal family, and they were arrested in Varennes on June the 21st, 1791. Taken back to Paris under guard, the king was now seen as a traitor to the revolution because he attempted to flee from his responsibility. And in their eyes, he was potentially gathering forces to overthrow the revolutionary government. So it set the stage for that radical phase of the revolution, the eventual abolition of the monarchy, and of course, the ultimate execution of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. Number 12. She was the target of political pornographers and gossip. Oh yeah, Talk about kicking a person when they're down. They never let up on it, not for a second. Not only was she apparently responsible for the entire debt of France and the poverty of the poor, but apparently she was also sexually voracious and had no morals whatsoever. So going back to those pamphlets that I talked about previously, there was other types of pamphlets as well. These ones were pornographic and they were circulated in underground circles. And they basically portrayed her in really graphic and sexually explicit scenarios, often involving multiple men and women as well. And they were part of this genre known as political pornography, which used sexual scandal and moral depravity as metaphors for political corruption and abuse of power. But alongside the pornographic depictions, there was rumours of her affairs. These were rampant. And they included allegations of affairs with men, affairs with women, and probably most famously, the Swedish Count Axel von Fersen, with whom she was apparently very close to him. There was many letters that went backwards and forwards between the two that certainly would make you raise your eyebrows, let's put it that way. You wouldn't necessarily believe that they were innocent. But historians debate the nature of her relationship with him because everything was so exaggerated for political purposes that it's hard to know whether that was true or not. Number 13, I did mention this at the beginning. She adopted many children. We have her as this frivolous, self-absorbed party animal, and she was some of the time, but she wasn't all of the time. She had this lovely, compassionate side to her, especially towards children in need. And so, contrary to this portrayal of her being completely indifferent, she had a soft spot for orphans. And she adopted several during her time. And this act of kindness extended from providing for their education and welfare, and in some cases, bringing them into the palace to live. Well, there's four that I know of that she took under her wing. There was others as well, but they're not as well recorded. There was a boy called Armand. So this boy was nearly killed in an accident in front of her carriage. And because of this, Marie Antoinette adopted him and his siblings, and she brought Armand to live with her at Versailles. But not a very nice boy, as it turns out, because he turned against the royal family during the revolution. But he got his comeuppance because he died in 1792. Then there was Ernestine. So she was brought in as a companion for Marie Antoinette's daughter, Marie-Thérèse Charlotte. And after Ernestine's mother died, the queen decided to adopt us. And she was treated exactly the same as all her other children. And then there was Jean Amilcar, and he was a young Senegalese boy who was given to the queen as a gift. But instead of making him a servant, which would have been quite normal for that time, she had him baptized and cared for at the palace. Unfortunately, though, he did die on the streets of Paris after the royal family couldn't support him any longer because, you know, they were imprisoned. And he was then imprisoned and ultimately died. And then there was Zoe, who was one of three orphaned girls that Marie Antoinette decided to adopt after their parents died. She was brought in as a companion for Louis Charles. What happened to the children of Marie Antoinette? Oh, it's sad. And they, you know, a lot of them, well, there was four in total, and they had varying fates following the fall of the French monarchy. They had Marie-Thérèse, who was the eldest, then Louis-Joseph, Louis-Charles, and Sophie. So Marie-Thérèse, she was also known as Madame Royale. She was the only one to survive into adulthood. She spent many years in prison during the revolution, but she was released in 1795 and then later married her cousin, Louis Antoine, who was the Duke of Angoulême. She lived until she was 72, but she didn't have any children. Louis Joseph, who was the eldest son and heir, died of tuberculosis at the age of 7. Louis Charles, he was the one that was proclaimed King Louis XVII by the royalists. He died at the age of 10. Officially, it was supposed to be some sort of an infection, but it was actually probably more down to his harsh conditions and imprisonment. And then Sophie, the youngest child, she died at just 11 months in 1787. So that was well before the start of the revolution. Number 14. This one's a little happier. She made the poof hairstyle famous. So the poof hairstyle, it became a hallmark of fashion among the French aristocracy, and it was a symbol of opulence and excess that was really associated with Marie Antoinette's court. And it was caricaturized by its extraordinary height and complexity. And you got it like that by backcombing the hair to just create lots and lots of volume, a bit like in the 80s. They used various supports like wireframes and pads to just hold the whole structure in place. And the hairstyle was then just adorned with this array of decorations. And it could be anything from feathers, flowers. There was even miniature replicas of ships, live birds, you name it, it could be put into this hairstyle. And Marie Antoinette's adoption and then adaptation of this poof elevated it to an art form. It was a political statement. And her versions would often include elaborate themes that were designed to convey messages or celebrate events or express personal interests. For example, she famously wore a pouf that featured a model of the French ship La Belle Poule commemorating a naval victory. So this showcased her support for the French Navy, but also showed the potential of the pouf as a canvas for expression. It's cool, isn't it? Here's the not so nice bit. With this hairstyle came the fleas. Ew. Because to recreate this style, it required an extensive use of pomades that were made from animal fats and powders. And these were made from starch to maintain that structure and appearance. So these, combined with the infrequent washing of hair and wigs, was just a breeding ground for parasites. And to help with the discomfort caused by the fleas and the lice, they created this special tool known as the head scratcher. And what it did, it became a bit of a fashion accessory, really. It allowed people to scratch their scalps without ruining their hairstyle or damaging their wig. So it was long with a slender handle. It was often made of ivory or silver or wood. And at the end was a small set of prongs. And that was the scratching element. I think I'd rather have gone without the wig. Number 15. I like this one. She was responsible for creating the first celebrity fashion designer. I mean, now in this day and age, there are many, many, many celebrity fashion designers. But Marie Antoinette's influence on fashion, it extended way beyond her personal style choices. She played a pivotal role in creating what we now know as the celebrity fashion designer. Rose Bertin, often referred to as the Minister of Fashion, is generally considered to be the first celebrity fashion designer. And she got that status mainly due to her association with the Queen. So she was born in 1747 and she was a milliner and dressmaker. And she rose to prominence in Paris because of her beautiful designs. And she had a really good sense of fashion. Her relationship with Marie Antoinette began in the early 1770s when she was first introduced to the Queen. The Queen just loved her. She loved her talent, her creativity, and she very quickly made her the official dressmaker of the court. And of course, this endorsement provided Bertin with unprecedented access to the highest and most famous people in Paris society. So this helped her influence in fashion to really grow. Before her, dressmakers and milliners were just seen as mere craftsmen. But because of her collaboration with the Queen, it just elevated that profession. That profession became known as that of an artist and a trendsetter. So this transformation really allowed designers to gain recognition for their work and to influence fashion on a much, much broader scale. One thing before we finish off, which I discovered and thought was absolutely brilliant, was that Marie Antoinette had a death mask. And this is a question that I've been asked a few times now. What was the Marie Antoinette death mask? Well, it all started with Marie Tussauds. So, the founder of Madame Tussauds in London. Well, she had a lot of connections with the monarchy at the time. But unfortunately, Marie, not Marie Antoinette, but this Marie, she was targeted by revolutionaries because she was labelled as a supporter of the royals. And that led to her being arrested. The situation kind of escalated right to the point where she was literally being prepared for execution by guillotine. Her head had been shaved a lot, but she was released on one condition, that she employed her skills in wax modelling to create casts of those who fell victim to the revolution. And these casts were known as death masks, and they were made from the actual severed heads of the deceased. I mean, that's a pretty horrible task at the best of times, but it was made worse by the fact that many of the people that she was forced to immortalize in wax were her friends. And this included Marie Antoinette and her husband. So Marie held the severed head of King Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. I can't think of anything worse. There you have it. There are your 15 interesting, probably little known facts about Marie Antoinette. I really hope you enjoyed finding out more about her because I loved researching it. Now, on next week's episode, I'm going to be bringing on my very first guest onto the podcast, the lovely Emily Willett. And she's a British expat living in France. And she's now living her best French life, helping to run a cognac vineyard in the beautiful Charente. She speaks fluent French. And you know what? In my eyes, she's got the best job in the world. But is it all it's cracked up to be? Well, we're going to find out next week when I chat to Emily, and she'll be sharing her journey to living and working in France. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Life in Rural France podcast. Remember to visit lifeinruralfrance.com/podcast to get notified every time I release a new episode. And if you enjoy the podcast, I'd love you to leave me a review and subscribe. And don't forget to send in your questions for Listener of the Week, where I answer your questions about France in the show. So until the next time, I hope I've filled your life with a sprinkle of French sunshine and a lot of French fun.